Last week, we talked about, or we learned from, the woman with the issue of blood, and we asked you to contemplate, what's your issue? What's your thing that you finally realize God is the only source? What is your thing that you have tried everything else to resolve? And finally, you realize that the world is not going to give you the answer. What's your issue? What's your thing? And we learned that many may touch God. Many may come into contact with Jesus. Many may be found in his presence or the presence of his people. But not all touches are the same. Not all touches are the same. And in the Greek, we explored the fact that that word is haptomai. And it doesn't mean just to brush up against or to be in the presence of or to a mere touch. It means to grab a hold of, to come into contact with, but to connect yourself to something or someone, to cling to. And so when someone realizes that Jesus is really that important in their lives, that's a touch that he feels. That's something that moves him, something that stops him in his tracks and gets him to take notice. I want to be the kind of Christian that Jesus takes notice of, so that with all of the folks thronged around him, there was that one touch, the only healing that he did not voluntarily do. This was a healing that came from a heart that Jesus could not resist. And so his healing virtue, his dunamis power for healing, flowed from him while he was yet looking another direction, trying to press through the crowd in order to heal a dying young woman. But while she was dying, Jesus had to know who this person was that was causing the healing, dunamis power, virtue for healing to leave his body. And so with that in mind, today we're going to look at this from a different angle. Same subject, basically. But today is really a matter of a warning, a caveat. And that is, don't count the people. Don't count the people. If you have been counting the people, stop counting the people. And as often is the case, we learn from fairly well-known verses of Scripture. But as usually is the case, you're going to learn something you didn't know before. And so today, as you might imagine, we're going to be learning from King David, if you hadn't figured that out already. And really, even though it sounds like it's a church thing, it's not really. It's certainly not about the size of the church. This message is real for small to mega. If your numbers are small, you should not be counting the ability for God to come through by the numbers. But if through all of your fancy footwork and marketing and programs you've achieved the label of mega church, don't you think that your provision comes through the numbers? Amen. Stop counting the people. All it will do is lead you astray, and we're going to learn today that it creates an opening for Satan. Don't count the people. This is not a sob story. This is not an encouragement just for those who are struggling with small numbers. It's a warning to those that feel like they have it all figured out. They've got the masses listening to every word that drips off their lips. They've got the programs that are the envy of all around. They've got the beautiful basilica or buildings. Don't count that. Don't judge your outcome by that. And so this is not a church thing. Really, it could be just about anything. So today we're going to learn a few things, and we're going to go to the word in just a second. There are times when we take three steps forward in our lives, and then we take two steps back, and we wonder why we're not making progress. What you probably didn't know is much of the time it's because you're counting the people. There are times when Satan is able to come in and take advantage of your weaknesses. Oftentimes it's because you're counting the people. And when we talk about touching God in a meaningful way, many times we are distracted and not able to really walk in the Spirit, which is what touches him, and faith. Emphasize faith. It's because we're counting the people. So we need to stop counting the people. So we're going to learn from the book of 1 Chronicles today. So you can go ahead and turn there and or mark your Bibles. 1 Chronicles chapter 21. And we're going to be focusing, our main text will be verses 1 through 8. But I wrestled with this issue and I finally conclude that we've just got to stop by to create the context in the book of 2 Samuel. So please mark that as well. That will be 2 Samuel chapter 23 and 24. Now, obviously, we're not going to go and touch on everything, but specifically in chapter 23, we're going to be looking at verses 8 through 17, and we're going to stop just for a second and look at the first verse of chapter 24. Now, this is not a new message. It might be a fresh text because we've covered lots of the New and the Old Testament over this past year. But we have not spent a whole lot of time talking about Brother David, King David. Today we're going to learn from the king. And as is often the case with David, we learn from his mistakes more than anything else. We learn at his expense. And so before we do anything else, let's go ahead and look at our text. Let's see what it has to say, and then we'll double back and begin to understand what's in it for us. Stop counting the people. Don't count the people. Don't judge your situation by the number of people or even the quality, power, and talent of the people. That's counterintuitive, but most things godly are counterintuitive. So let's look at chapter 21, and we'll read these first eight verses, and I'm reading from the New King James. It says, "Now Satan stood up against Israel and moved David to number Israel. So David said to Joab and to the leaders of the people, 'Go number Israel from Beersheba to Dan, and bring the number of them to me, and that I may know it.' And Joab answered, 'May the Lord make his people 100 times more than they are. But my lord the king, are they not all my lord's servants? Why then does my lord require this thing? Why should he be a cause of guilt in Israel?'" In other words, this is a warrior here speaking to David. He is not the king, nor is he a spiritual man, but he somehow knows that this is wrong, what the king is doing. But we'll learn more deeply a little bit later. Part of the problem is that he's telling the king that it's wrong, but he's going to do the wrong anyhow. Verse 4, "Nevertheless, the king's word prevailed against Joab." So even though Joab knew the right thing to say when it came to God's expectations and the king, he followed the king. Therefore, Joab departed, and he went throughout all Israel and came to Jerusalem. Then Joab gave the sum of the number of the people to David. All Israel had 1,100,000 men who drew the sword. And Judah had 470,000 men who drew the sword. But he did not count Levi and Benjamin among them, for the king's word was an abomination to Joab. So we know how Joab felt, but he had done it anyway. And then, just so that we can make this clear, verse 7 says, and God was displeased with this thing, just in case you wondered if there was a way out, just in case you wondered if there was some fine print. God is displeased with this numbering of the people. And as a result, he struck Israel. Verse 8, as is typical of David, so David said to God, I have sinned greatly. David had repenting down pat. He says, I have sinned greatly because I have done this thing. But now I pray, take away the iniquity of your servant, for I have done very foolishly. So now we have, in essence, what we need to know about the story for us to know what was done, the fact that it was wrong, the fact that God was upset, the fact that he had warning, he had someone trying to talk him out of it. But unfortunately, there were two factors working heavily or mightily against him. One was Satan himself. But as we know, Satan can't work by himself. He cannot work by himself. As a matter of fact, he can't come to you. He can't step to you this way without permission. And that's where we have to go over to 2 Samuel. And so let's wrap this thing up. Let's make sure we fully understand the context. And so if you look at 2 Samuel, the same chapter 24, the same events are described. But it's worded slightly differently. It says, again, the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel. So the Lord is actually upset with the entire nation of Israel. Yes, they were winning lots of military battles, but spiritually, they had gone awry. The people were not worshiping God as they should, and frankly, all the while, all of these battles were happening, and they were becoming degenerate spiritually. This is when Uriah died. Because David, the king, the great warrior, just had to have what he had to have. Looking over at Bathsheba, having his desire get kindled and then burn into a fire. He had to have Bathsheba. And so one of the darkest days of David's life was when he sent one of his 30 mighty men, Uriah, out to a battle where he knew he would be killed. He rationalized that this was an okay way to take his wife, oh, the poor widow woman that he would take in as the great hero king, the great benevolent one. He would take in the weeping widow woman. But of course, we know that he planned it all along. This is one of the blackest portions of David's life. And so we see here that God was angry with all of Israel, but God chose the method by which he would justify his punishment for Israel, and he would do so through David himself. And so he knew, understand this is critical, he knew that David would count the people. He knew this. But why hadn't he? This is important. Why hadn't he counted the people up to this point? The same reason you're not more degenerate than you are right now. There are many weaknesses that we have that are not seen by others. We only talk about what's seen and known. But we all have weaknesses, and the only thing keeping us from falling is the hedge that God puts up. It even looked like Job didn't have a weakness, but he had one. The weakness didn't come out when his family was attacked. The weakness didn't come out when his stuff was attacked. The Lord giveth, he taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. He would not curse God and die. But we learn that he had a weakness when Satan was finally allowed to attack Job himself. Now, wait a minute. Now, you're pushing this a little bit too far, Job said. Wait a minute. Now, I pray and intercede for my children because I'm the great Job. But, oh, no, you're touching me now? Excuse me? I'm above that. I'm beyond that. I've done nothing. In my place here in Israel, we believe that if you suffer, you must be cursed. You must have done something wrong. Not me. And so the book of Job, as we've talked about before, was not about the patience of Job, even though he showed some patience. It was about the sovereignty of God. It was about when we are at our best, when God can brag about us. We still are in trouble if God lowers that hedge. So when you get the big head, remember who created all this. Remember who created you. And remember, even at your best, you still need God. But we don't know it so keenly because he allows the hedge of his grace and his mercy to remain. But even though it's not stated explicitly here, you can tell by what is said that God is lowering the hedge for David here. And he is allowing Satan to tempt David, and he knows David's weakness. And we're going to come to understand how this weakness came to be so that hopefully we can be better when we have to face our day of challenge. So it says, again, the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel, and he moved David against them, meaning he had David to do something that Israel would suffer for, and to say, go number Israel and Judah. So now we understand what he did wrong, and we understand from the natural and the spiritual why he did it. He had a little help. He had a little push from Satan. But we also understand what created the opening for Satan to come, both God's actions in lowering the hedge and David's frame of mind, just like Eve's frame of mind and that fruit that she had been eyeing for so long. So you had the fruit and her eyeing it like that person in the window, as I described about a year ago. And Adam somewhere else. Perfect setup. But it was in her heart all along, and that's what Satan preys on. So what's your thing? What's in your heart? What is that weakness? What is that thing where you may think you're stronger than you really are? God is keeping a hedge up. And we really don't want that hedge to be lowered. We don't want our stuff to be out there, do we? So now I want to show you what is the likelihood, or what is likely the reason why David had this problem. And from that, we will come to learn how to manage our problem. Is that all right? Yeah. All right. So now, when it comes to this situation, there is some debate among theologians and commentators about whether David numbered the people because he was basking in the glory of all of his victories. This man was on the top of his military game at this point. He had destroyed pretty much all the Philistines and everyone in the land. And quite gruesomely, I might add. But was he basking in the glory of his victories and wanting to number all the folk who would follow him into battle if he just said the word? Or was he rather counting them to make sure that there were enough for a future battle? Certainly, by the words of Joab, it would appear that he had some concern about the numbers, and Joab seemed to be trying to console him. He seemed to be trying to reassure him. God could multiply these people tomorrow. God can multiply these people tomorrow. Emphasize, God can multiply these people tomorrow. And then you could see it. So why would you number them is the question. And so we can argue and debate, and theologians do, but frankly, there are other theories too, by the way, on top of those. But frankly, it is very likely that he was numbering them, both in pride, but also because he had come to the point to where the carnal, the physical, the natural in his life was dominating the spiritual. That is likely David's problem. That is likely what created the opening for Satan to enter in. And in the end, we can debate about it, but I think you figured out by now, it does not matter. Either way, he's wrong. Either way, when we do similarly, we are wrong. You're not supposed to count the people. We're talking about God folk here. If you're not a God person, if you're not following the Lord, I suppose you can count all you want. But if you're supposed to be following the Lord, you shouldn't be counting the people. Now, in a moment, we'll talk about how we count the people. But I really think for you to absorb this properly, we really need to go to this text in 2 Samuel chapter 23. Because I want you to understand what David was working with before we judge him too quickly. Let's see why he might have counted the people, why he might have come to depend on, rely on, believe in, have faith in, stand on the foundation of the people. But if you look at 2 Samuel, you'll see all sorts of victories won by David over his enemies. But as you read 2 Samuel, and the same thing with 1 Chronicles, as you get up to 21, the narrative starts much more dominantly talking about God's contribution to the victories. But by this time, if you look at the chapters around it, it's focusing on the mightiness of the men. Yes, David, when he was running from King Saul, he built up a band of men, great fighting men, that numbered about 400. These were serious fighting men who sent many fleeing. But then David had an elite band of commandos, 30 men, greater than all the rest. And on top of that, he had three that were super elite that did even greater things. David's mighty men. Emphasis, David's mighty men. Anywhere you read in the Bible, it's going to say David's mighty men. These were men committed to David, not committed to God per se. Notwithstanding Joab trying to keep David from doing the wrong thing, understand who he was committed the most to. Did he not go ahead and do the thing? These are David's mighty men. So let's learn a little bit more about David. Starting at verse 8, these are the names of the mighty men who David had. Does it say who God had? It says who David had. Now, I may struggle with some of these names. Josheb, Bashabeth, the Tachbonite, chief among the captains. He was called Adino the Esnite because he had killed how many? 800 men at what? One time. Now let's just absorb that. 800 men at one time. Now, if you're rolling with somebody like that, you might be a little bit tempted to start counting the people. You might start thinking that this is not a God thing. Man, I've got some tough guys rolling with me. 800 people at one time committed to you. That might puff up the ego a little bit. You got some guy like this coming to you, rolling with you, and looking up to you, willing to do whatever you say? Come on now. That'll have your head puffed up just a little bit. It says, and after him was Eleazar, the son of Dodo, the Ahohite, one of the three mighty men with David when they defied the Philistines, who were gathered there for battle. And the men of Israel had retreated. Now, so the other men of Israel had retreated. They had turned tail and run. But not these three. Not these three mighty men. It says, this Eleazar, it says, he rose and he attacked the Philistines until his hand was weary. And his hand stuck to the sword. And then we get a little lip service for the Lord. It says the Lord brought about a great victory that day, and the people returned after him only to plunder. So the people ran. This guy took care of all the business, and they came to pick up the spoils. So what did we learn here? Not only was he mighty, but this is a man with the singleness of mind, singleness of purpose. He didn't stop swinging the sword. He didn't even take his hand off of it. So much so that it was stuck to it. What that means is, as he swung the sword, there's a little bit of movement in the sword. It's not totally attached. And so there's friction, and it creates blisters. And when that liquid comes out and it dries, it sticks to your hand. This is the kind of guy that David had answering to his every request. That might get you focusing a little bit on the natural, a little bit on man-made power. That might make you think a little bit more about the mighty man part of this than about the Lord, even though it's mentioned. Verse 11, it says, and after him was Shammah, the son of Agi, and the Hararite. The Philistines had gathered together into a troop where there was a piece of ground full of lentils. So the people fled, here we go again, from the Philistines. Same story. The people fled. That includes the other so-called soldiers. But he stationed himself. We're talking about this Shammah, this mighty fighting man. He stationed himself in the middle of the field. In other words, bring it on. Bring it on. Come on. That's fine. The other folks are gone, but no, you're going to deal with me. You're not taking this field. I know there's a lot of you, but you're going to deal with me. That's fine. Just bring it on. This is Shammah talking. He said he stationed himself in the middle of the field and defended it and killed the Philistines. So the Lord brought about a great victory. Now, notice, we still have the Lord bringing about the great victory. But the greater emphasis is on the mightiness of these men. And even if you didn't want to think of them as mighty, their feats definitely take you there. And then we get to this three. Then three of the 30 chief men went down at harvest time. And what time is harvest time? Summer. So now what do we know, therefore? It's hot. Okay? In this time, not so different from now, kings would plan their military battles during the winter. They did not attempt to fight during the winter. And springtime was when the blood began to flow, when the ice was melted and the snow was no longer something that would encumber them. Springtime was when the battles began and on into the summer. But the bottom line here is that we know that these three of the 30 went down at harvest time, that is summertime, and came to David at the cave of Adullam, and the troop of Philistines encamped in the valley of Rephaim. David was then in the stronghold, and the garrison of the Philistines was then in Bethlehem. So the picture you need to have in your mind is that David is in a cave. The Philistines are encamped around Bethlehem. In verse 15, and David said, and this is, every time I read this, it just grabs me. David said with longing, "Oh, that someone would give me a drink of water from the well of Bethlehem, which is by the gate." Now, this is the king. He's got these great men doing his every beck and call, right? And he's not asking to have his life saved. He's not asking for a battle to be fought. It's summertime. Boy, I sure would like to have a good drink of water. Oh, but not just any water. Water from, you know, the well in Bethlehem. Well, not just any well in Bethlehem. I want the water from the well that's in Bethlehem by the gate, which, by the way, is protected by all these giant Philistines. So what we don't know is whether or not he was just saying this and the other gentleman overheard it, or whether he was really having the audacity to say, you know, I sure would, guys, you know, I sure would like to have some water from that particular well, knowing all along what it would take to get to that water. But that we don't know, but here's what we do know. It says, so the three mighty men broke through the camp of the Philistines. I'm sure just like Navy SEALs or Delta Force, broke through the camp of the Philistines and drew the water from the well of Bethlehem that was by the gate, and took it and brought it to David. Three men. And this is sort of the coup de grace here. After all that, David didn't even bother to drink the water. Poured it out. And tried to justify it with a little spiritual angle. Because they never did drink the blood of the animals. He didn't partake of the blood of the animals of sacrifices. David wants to say, well, you know, Lord, there's no way I'm going to drink this. This is like the blood of a sacrifice. These three men sacrificed their lives. They put their lives in jeopardy to do this for me, as if he didn't ask for it. So he gets all spiritual about it. So for a minute, I want you to take the spiritual part out of it. I want you to contemplate the fact that he says, oh, well, you know, I sure would like to have some water. These men sacrificed their lives or put at least them on the line. They come back with the water. And he has the nerve not to even drink it, and yet more to pour it out. Where do you think this man's head is at? Or rather, a different question, how big do you think it is? This is David. Yeah, we know him as the little runt that man saw as the last choice, but God saw as number one. Yeah, this is David, we know, as the adulterer. Yes, we know that, David. Yes, this is David, the great psalmist and dancer. Yes, it's all of that. But David was, by and large, more than anything, a warrior. And obviously, a cold blooded warrior, hardcore warrior. So if you wonder why he could not build God's temple, you start to see a little bit more detail about the blood that was shed. Remember these 30 mighty men, not the three, but 30. Remember, Uriah was one of those men with this kind of commitment to David, this kind of loyalty to David. What David did to him takes on a whole different light. And it's the very reason why the sword would never leave David's family. Most of his headaches came as a result, initially of Saul, but later because of his own actions. While his men were fighting, he was stealing one of their wives. And so we see here what I just described to you, what David says. And he said, "Far be it from me, O Lord, that I should do this, drink this water. Is this not the blood of the men who went in jeopardy of their lives?" Therefore, he would not drink it. And these things were done by the three mighty men. So now I think we understand where David's head was at. And so now that you understand where his head was at, now you can see why once God lowered the hedge, there was an opening. Satan didn't just come and give him an original thought. "Man, you know what, check it out. You should count the people." No, David was already thinking like this. He already had reason to be focused on what people can do for you. The mightiness of the men and the number. If you have mighty men plus the numbers, now what can you do? You can do even greater things. Now, Satan being Satan, he probably, we don't know this, but we have other examples to help us understand. He probably said, "Oh my God, look at the great things you did for God. If you had an even greater force, woo, what you could do for him." Ooh, yeah, you know, you got a point there. Or you deserve a bow. You know you deserve a bow. All of this that you've done, these men that you've led. Boy, you should count them all up and just see how many have been willing to follow you. You must be a great man of God. Now, it really doesn't matter which one it is. What matters is that obedience is better than sacrifice. What matters is that God doesn't want you to count the people. Now, we also count people. And we've got David's situation figured out pretty well, right? And he counted the people because he was a warrior and he wanted to count the fighting men. Some would say he wasn't counting men that were really ready to fight, but he was counting men that he might bring into the army, and he was assessing the possibilities. But people in this story for us really represent human ability, physical capability, mental capability. So mental faculties, the smarter you are, the more likely you are to lean on your smarts. The more money you have, the more likely you are to lean on your money to get you in and out of trouble. The more power you have, the more likely you are to use that as opposed to elbow grease to accomplish what it is you want to accomplish. The more intelligent you are, the more likely you are to try to think your way out of a situation. The more likely you are to want to have make a name for yourself. And so what God is showing us here is that the more we lean on our own understanding, our own capabilities, the more that's going to take us away from him. Does it mean that we shouldn't have capabilities? No, it does not mean that. He's the one that gave them to us. Does it mean that if you have capable people working with or for you, that that's a bad thing? No. The problem is that the more success we have, the more vulnerable we become. If David hadn't been successful with these men, he would not be thinking that men or more men were the answer. Now, the other issue that pertains to us here is that David had the opportunity, as we read all through 2 Samuel there, he had the opportunity to either focus on the mightiness of the men or the mightiness of God. Every battle that Israel ever fought, they were always outnumbered. So if you get down to one man or three men, then it should stand to reason for a spiritual person to say that God is the one that did this. But you could just as easily, especially if they're doing your bidding, you could just as easily focus on the mightiness of the men. Well, one man did this. One can send 1,000 to flight and 2 10,000, right? So who gets the credit, the one or the two or God? Well, if they're working for you, if they do anything you say, you might start thinking it's the people. It's not God. It's a temptation. And only success brings that. But lest you imagine only great success being our problem, let's get a little more relative. All right. We're talking about our joy being stolen. This is one of the lessons of today. Because we count the people, our joy is stolen. Many of us are dealing with issues, frustrations, worries, doubts. Why? When we could have joy because God is on our side, and the least little bit, the least intelligent, the least wealthy person plus God is always more than enough. But we don't think of it that way. We're counting the people. Guess what? If your home value is going down or not going up fast enough, you know the only reason why you get to have that worry? Because God blessed you with a home. If your health is beginning to fail you and you've got some challenges, you know the only reason you have that to pay attention to? Because God had blessed you with health. If you think you need to have more money in order to make it, the reason you get to have that complaint is because you have some money already. The problem is that you're not thinking of God as the source of your provision. So you see your cup is half empty when, frankly, with God, your cup is always overflowing. David, God can multiply those people tomorrow if he wants to, today, right now. Why are you counting them? Because the truth is, we really haven't figured out how to get our minds wrapped around the fact that what we have, God gave us. And just like David, we can look back on our lives and we can see many mountains we have climbed. We can see many battles that have been won. We can see many miracles that have been wrought on our behalf. And yet we break God's heart day in and day out by ignoring, minimizing, or forgetting the fact that he has done that for us. That as we get halfway across the bridge, Jesus was the bridge halfway across. So what's the problem with the other half? We tend to forget. And not just forget, we tend to prefer to focus on the natural. It feels better. It feels better when we can get the credit or be the ones to give credit to those who will give something back to us in the natural. just doesn't feel as good to give God the credit. And yet, it is in your giving God the credit for what it is that you have that reminds you that he is your provision for what it is you need. And if the creator of the universe is your provision for what it is you need, you've got all kinds of joy. You've got no problems, no worries, no hand wringing. But we choose fear, doubt, worry, and confusion. We choose to focus on the human abilities and therefore the frailties. We choose to put ourselves in a position to be disappointed because of who we choose to ride with. Even these mighty men could have disappointed David. But the only reason that they didn't is because of God, not the mightiness of the men. And so as we prepare to wrap up, my hope is that you've come to understand that any human capacity, even the smallest amount, if you add God to that, it is always more than enough. Not almost enough, not barely enough, not maybe enough, always more than enough. And so David had repeatedly had opportunities to look at this in the proper perspective, look at it the right way. But he chose, for the reasons we've described here, to think of it in the natural and to count the people. So in those victories, was it God that brought the victories or was it the mightiness of the men? Which one was it? Ultimately, David's problem is that he made the wrong choices. We know, and David knew, that God's hand was in all of his victories, all of his successes. Unfortunately, he emphasized the human aspect of it. He trusted and focused on mainly the natural abilities of people. And unfortunately, in our lives, in many ways, we do the same exact thing. And when there are those that we go to battle with, go to war with, that are loyal to us, we also are subject to getting the big head and wanting more and more of that. That also causes us to think more carnally. And so in the end, what is it that we can do to minimize the chances that we'll have this problem? We have to maximize the spiritual and minimize the carnal. We've talked about this before. If you think you're spiritual, you think you got it all covered, but you choose to hang out with those who are not, you choose to spend a whole lot of time with those who are not yoked properly with you, they will influence you more than you them. Don't you think that your Christianity, as much as however much of it you think you have, is like wet paint? It's not going to rub off on other people like you think. There'll be a few victories because God does it, not because of you. But it's not wise to think that you're going to impact the world by planting yourself in the midst of a whole lot of folks and justifying your spending time with them, you're hanging out with them, you're doing the stuff that they do. I promise you, you'll go some places you shouldn't go with them before they'll come to church with you. I'll let you think about that for a minute. It's true. The spiritual has to be maximized while the carnal, the natural, is minimized. So if you are walking with God, you need to think about who else is walking with you. And if they're not equally yoked with you, you likely have a problem. A bigger problem than you think. The other thing is, if you may say, well, no, I'm a balanced Christian. I'm a balanced person. You know, I pay attention to the carnal and I pay attention to the spiritual. I would give you kudos for that. However, if they both have equal billing, I'm going to tell you what's going to win. If God lowered the hedge right now, all of our stuff would be on display. The natural, the carnal will win. You can't allow them to have equal billing. This balanced stuff definitely has its place, but just understand that we are always going to, because of this flesh that we wrapped in, we're always going to shift or lean toward the natural, toward the natural tendencies of this sinful flesh. And so in the end, if God is not clearly recognized as your provision, as your leader, as your guide, as the one that you go to for advice, and when he tells you what to do, that's what you're going to do. And you're not going to do whatever you wanted to do anyway. If God is not clearly recognized as your ultimate source, like that woman with the issue of blood last week, if he is not clearly recognized, and if he doesn't clearly have that place in your life, then no matter how much you give lip service or even driving service to church, when the deal goes down, it's going to be clear that you are focused more dependent upon your money, your power, your influence, the size of your church, the number of people who happen to follow you, the number of phone calls you get, the number of people that come to your house for an event. All of these are the things that you're going to depend on. These are the things you're going to lean on. And you can't serve two masters. You're either leaning on those things or you're leaning on God. We just have David's example here to help us understand. So lip service won't do it. And so you won't make progress in your life when you should be making progress. Like, why am I not making progress? I should be. Well, maybe you're counting the people. If your cup is half empty too often when it should be overflowing, maybe you're counting the people. If you should have joy in your life, or you had joy and now you don't have joy, maybe you're counting the people. Maybe you're depending too much on yourself. Maybe you're depending too much on the job. Maybe you're depending too much on your career. Maybe you're depending too much on your education. Maybe you're depending too much on your relationships where you can influence. Maybe you're depending on someone that God has a right to be jealous of. And we don't want God to feel that way. He deserves better than that, because whatever it is that we have, if we think it's not enough, it's more than enough. And whatever we have, we got it how? From God in the first place. We need to get that straight. And if you ever think that you're getting away with it, understand that both God and Satan know the difference. You're not fooling anybody but yourself and a few people around you who choose to be fooled. If we're going to be at our best, not only do we need to recognize that both God and Satan know the difference between lip service and true service, the question is, do you know the difference? Do you know the difference between lip service and true service? Do you know the difference? Do you know who woke you up this morning? Do you know who drove you here or allowed you to have the faculties to drive here? Do you know why you got that job? My interviewing skills? No. A good reference? No. Why did you get that promotion? Because I deserved it? No. God keeps that hedge up. God is merciful and gracious. God is always up in your stuff, but we don't acknowledge him. Imagine that. So he's brokenhearted and we're disadvantaged. Our best position is to acknowledge that we have the creator of the universe on our side. But we have the all-knowing, all-powerful, ever-present creator of the universe on our side. Why is it that we fail to realize that? Why is it that we fail to acknowledge that? Why is it that we fail to take advantage of that? And we go ahead and sin anyhow. It's because of what you've been thinking about. It's because of what you've been hiding. It's because of what you've been truly focused on that God and Satan know. So this is your opportunity to work some of that stuff out before a moment comes where God is sick of your stuff or sick of some folks' stuff that are around you that he knows if he impacts you, he can get to them. This is an opportunity for us to get a few things right before God lowers that hedge and we learn from the school of hard knocks. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Do not allow us, God, to go out and do our own thing, our own way, but drag us if you have to, forcibly away from the sin that we would do or the sinful one, that is the evil one, Satan. That part of the Lord's Prayer is critical. Lead us not into temptation, which is what was happening there in Samuel. Don't allow us, Lord. Don't allow us, Lord, to let Satan in. Don't lower that hedge and allow him to take advantage of my frailties. One, Lord, take out my iniquities. Help me work them out. But in the end, if we do slip up, we want to be like David. God gave him three choices for him and the nation of Israel to suffer. David chose the choice that put him into the hands of God instead of the hands of men. David understood who God was, just like we do or should, but he just didn't take advantage. He just didn't stick and stay. But that's being a victim of success. So if you ever want to, or if you feel you are successful, understand the lessons of David. Really incorporate the lessons of Job, those who were successful but were the victims of their own success. Please remember that God is with you, and if he's for you, who in the world can be against you?